You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 10th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Cheryl Cashin, professor of the Georgetown University Law Center, author of White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and the Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Also on the program today, Manchin pulls his own economic package, supposedly ends all talks about passing legislation to help Americans. That's nice. Supreme Court expected to quash Biden's employer COVID test mandate soon because, you know, it's just a pandemic. 19 people die in New York's worst residential fire in decades. Chicago cancels school again and refused to work with teachers on a remote option. Three killers of Ahmaud Arbery sentenced to life in prison, only one eligible for parole. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin breaks his pledge and decides he will actually run for a third Senate term. Omicron creating worker shortages and pushing hospitals to the brink as deaths and hospitalizations creep up, or I should say shoot up, now that we're 21 days out from the first Omicron surge. Wrestling coach and Congressman Jim Jordan won't cooperate with the January 6th commission. He also, I guess, wouldn't cooperate with his former wrestlers in trying to stop a predator from molesting them. Yeah, but that's the side.
Yeah.
Afghanis faced a food and housing crisis in the wake of U.S. blocking aid and freezing assets. And Iowa Republicans ban journalists from the state Senate chambers. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, and making her triumphant return to the show to have an opportunity to comment on my beard in person.
Oh, right.
Emma Vigeland is here today.
I am back.
She is back.
I am back. I mean, what is there to say about the beard?
Right.
I mean, it's not just the beard. You also have gone with the clear lenses. Clear frames.
I get a different pair of frames.
Right.
Today, I can't see. I don't know what's going on. I think I'm tired or what, but I can't see anything.
Well, maybe they're too clear.
Yeah.
I don't know. You previously tried those on and you were like, I don't know if I should wear these on the show. And yet without my influence, when I'm away from the show,
yep,
you revert to,
I reverted. I got in the habit of wearing these over vacation just because I couldn't find the other glasses one day. And so I put these on and then you forget, then you get used to it. And then Saul challenged me to wear, to not shave my beard last week and so and do the show. So I did it.
Can't back away from a challenge.
No. And now I'm starting to think, like, maybe I'll just keep the beard until this Omicron thing passes.
Okay.
Maybe, like, until, like, the end of January or February or, you know, whatever. Maybe until 2032 when this whole thing passes.
Or until you get a roll in and just like that.
What's that?
Until you get a roll in and just like that.
And just like that.
That's the Sex in the City, new Sex in the City show.
I mean, we'll see. I will be honest with people. I have not gotten a call.
Yeah.
I no longer have an agent who sends me out to audition.
Big's out of the picture.
Huh?
Mr. Big's out of the picture.
He is.
Mr. Big is out of the picture.
I don't know if you've heard this. I mean, you could, yeah, you could make a triumphant return, and it is now about being old. That's what the whole show is, right? Carrie broke her, Carrie broke her hip. She had to pee in a bottle.
You know what? I was talking to a friend of mine the other night, and he was telling me that, like, they have hearing aids. And we're like, wait, how old are they supposed to be?
Oh, yes.
And Steve, our age.
Steve has hearing aids. Yeah, it's a little, it's, it really, they're fifth, they're,
what's
they're,
that?
Mid, they're in their mid fifth.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. They're in their mid fifties.
Thank you.
Who else is?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, maybe in the fun half, I'll tell my Chris Noth story. I think, I don't know if I've told that story.
You told it to us off air.
All right, man, I'll tell that story. We've got plenty to get to today. Obviously, still ongoing, you know, situation where it appears that the federal government and a lot of state and local governments have just decided we're just going to pretend that this thing is not happening, where we're getting, what, over a million infections a day in this country, close to it, where we're starting to see hospitalizations. And
over a million, you said, or over half a million?
I think at some days we're getting close to a million.
New York Times says averaging 500K cases.
Over 14 days.
Oh, wow.
I wonder where we're at. What was the most recent? I think we're up there.
Really?
And that's an average over 14 days.
Oof.
And we're watching a lot of places just sort of decide we're just going to ride it out. In New York City, the mayor just seems to be like, well, you know, if you test kids coming in, you're going to find out that they're positive. It's that type of deal. And, of course, now we're starting to see 21 days out, deaths rise, hospitalizations rise. We still don't know the implications of long COVID, specifically with Omicron, you know, in any type of, like, sort of meaningful way. So there's a lot of reason for concern. The hope is maybe this burns out quickly. That seems to be their plan. Let's just see if we can get through the next 3 weeks and everything will be fine. We'll see about that. But Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, has an interesting take on this. You know, one has to wonder, why do you order about a million tests if you are the governor of Florida? And the reason is obvious. Just to watch them expire and become bad. Why else would you pay for it? Here's Ron DeSantis.
Is it not like cheese?
Clip number five.
Does it not get better as time goes on?
Now think about it. Before COVID, did anyone go out and seek testing to determine if they were sick? It's usually you feel like you're sick, and then you get tested to determine what you're, what you maybe have come down with. And so this is kind of a new thing where they've been saying just go out and test all the time. And again, you're free to do it. But I think what the DOH guidance from Florida is saying is that is unlikely to yield very much clinical value for you. And it also creates a lot of second-order follow-up problems. It's essentially a lockdown by stealth in the sense of if you test positive but you're not sick or have symptoms, you may have to isolate. They don't even know. The test can't tell you if you're even infectious or not. And these PCR tests, you can test positive for weeks after you've been infected, months even in some cases. And so what happens is blanket testing of healthy people, it leads to some kids being not in school. It leads to people not being able to go to work and some doing some of these isolation, which is may not even be justified. And so I think those guidelines are very sensible. And again, it's not saying people can do what they want to do, but I can tell you to just do force healthy people like businesses to do that or whatever. We don't advise that at all. We think that's a mistake. We think people should live their lives. And then if they develop symptoms, you know, you can obviously get a test. And if you're at risk and the treatment would really change the course for you, we obviously want to see that treatment done.
Emma made the point that it's a little ironic. They're sitting there in front of a hurricane preparedness thing. Let's just talk about hurricanes. Like, you could prepare for a hurricane, but what if it doesn't come?
Yeah.
What if you board up your windows
and the hurricane doesn't come, then you gotta take the boards down. And then what if you while you're hammering the nails into the board that you put in and you smash your thumb? What are you going to do then?
If it's a waste of time, and your thumb's a little sore.
We could have a lot of people around the state with broken hands, and then you're going to be looking at like what are going to happen? How many orthopedic doctors do we have? You're going to have a breakdown of our orthopedic doctor system with the hurricane preparedness. That's what we're here for, to tell you: don't prepare unless you start to see the hurricane, unless you start to feel the wind blow. And not until we get about 50 miles per hour. That's when you start to prepare for the hurricane.
Well, it's interesting to me, too, because he mentions for you. You hear that, right? There's little clinical value for you, because the Republicans constantly want to make this an individual health issue as opposed to one that is a collective effort. That is what they've been trying to do. And by the way, the Biden administration doesn't seem to have that much of a response here, where it's just like, we're not going to shut down, we're not going to consider it, we're not going to have like a new approach, vaccinations, and then that's about it. And Democrats across the country are dealing with it the same way too, like here in New York as well. But this wasn't DeSantis. I think this was Rick Scott when he was governor. He wanted to, was this the case? He was trying to get a drug testing provision for welfare recipients. You can do preventative testing in order to make sure that people who need money are not getting government benefits. No, that is a huge priority. But preventative testing in order to stop the spread of a deadly disease. That's you can't do that. If you're asymptomatic, I mean, please only get tested if you are coughing up due to COVID.
It does sort of raise the question, why did you buy all those tests in Florida?
Yeah.
I mean, they're about to go bad. They're about to all expire. We got them just in case that we decided that we wanted to test and we decided we didn't want to test.
Probably because somebody made a buck on it. But like the idea that there was blanket testing, like, what are you talking about? People were testing themselves if they felt sick or because they were traveling, right? Like, it wasn't like you're just going to get tested because you're having fun.
I mean, the bottom line is that you want to test to protect others. You want to test because maybe you think that you've been in some way exposed by others, or you're feeling bad. The idea that, yes, that people are going out and like, you know what, we could go to a movie or we could just go to one of those mobile vans and get tested.
Oh, rage face there as our
thing up our nose.
Toes
exactly.
Freeze off. Yeah. I mean, no preventative care, preventative health care, useless. Don't get mammograms. Seriously.
Or STD tested. Just wait until something's wrong.
Yeah.
I don't want to kink shame, but there's a lot of people going around with those, going out on dates now with the, and then doing the nostril thing. And that's, I mean, it's a waste of test.
Don't knock it until you try it. Yeah. Don't knock it until you try it.
It's a waste of test. That's all I'm saying. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show and you get the fun half, as well as supporting the free show and getting the fun half. And a reminder, the Big Lie show, no longer on the anniversary of January 16th. It will be May 15th, 2 p.m. in Boston at the Wilbur Theater. Tickets still available. Some people canceled. Also, Kowalski, we got to get Kowalski onto the Discord. Apparently, he's got some tickets. He won't be able to make it because it's planting season. Mm. He wants to donate them to some Boston nurses. So, if you're around, there's another, that reminds me, there was a clip I was saving for your return. Cause, Patriots fan, Boston guy, heavy accent. We'll do that later.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Wow.
Talking about co-ops. It was pretty good. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code majority and you will get 10% off their great coffee from a free trade place. Want to welcome to the program Professor Cheryl Cashin. She's a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, author of White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding, and the Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Cheryl, welcome. Thanks for joining us. We're here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with, I mean, essentially you argue in this book that we have a caste system that exists that is a sort of, I guess, a fusion of both a racial and economic disparity. You start with Baltimore to illustrate this cast. Just give us a little bit of history about Baltimore. I didn't realize that I guess maybe this was Reconstruction, but post the Civil War, Baltimore was fairly segregated city in many respects, both geographically and across all sorts of lines. But take it from there in terms of Baltimore.
Well, the professor and me, can I just say, my argument is we have a system of residential caste that you can't understand economic and racial inequality in this country without understanding the role of geography. Where you live really defines your opportunities in life, and everybody of all colors in this country is trapped in residential caste. It happens to be that poor Black folks in high poverty neighborhoods, who I call descendants, are the worst off, but the minority of people who are in very affluent, hyper affluent white space are the best off. So just making that clear, I'm talking about residential caste. Yeah. Baltimore is a classic example of this, right? In the 1890s, and Baltimore was the city that inspired my man, Frederick Douglass, he's right there, right? That's my man, right? To seek freedom. It had the highest number of free Black people in the city, even during the slave period, right? But in the 1890s, if you were Black in Baltimore, you could, if you could afford it, live where you wanted, go in the stores, try on the clothes, right? It's only in the 19-teens, and this happens everywhere, when Black people start fleeing in droves from the South to escape Jim Crow and landing further north and west, the dominant response to Black great migrants is to contain them in their own neighborhoods, hyper-segregated neighborhoods, and then cut those neighborhoods off from the kind of resources, particularly federally backed mortgages, that are rained down on white neighborhoods, right? And you know, the same neighborhoods. And I take Baltimore through every period from, you know, the redlining of Black neighborhoods, HOLC in the 30s to urban renewal, the displacement of Black people who used to live in the most strategic areas near downtown to highways. Any major city with a critical mass of Black people, look at where the highways were laid in the 50s. Typically, they mowed them through often very vital Black neighborhoods and called, and then the construction of public housing. Black people who are displaced, they get put into, by HUD policies, intentionally segregated public housing, creating concentrated Black poverty where housing projects are. And you just keep going, right? In Baltimore, then I even with seven or eight Black mayors in a row, I say, yeah, what's happened with Black neighbors in the history is we contain Black people, and then we disinvest in those neighborhoods, overinvest in white neighborhoods. And I show this pattern in Baltimore. There's a study that showed that even with Black leadership, Black representation, the mayors and the majority of Black people on the city council, they found to their horror when they looked at it, they were spending four times as much in white neighborhoods as Black neighborhoods. And then when you keep going to the 2000s, under the Hogan administration, yeah, you know, what does Larry Hogan do? There's a light rail line called the Red Line, right? Ironically, for historically redlined Black neighborhoods. But for the first time since it was planned in 1965, they were going to finally build this light rail line that was going to connect the poorest black neighborhoods in East and West Baltimore to job centers downtowns and in the suburbs, took 15 years to get this done. And as soon as Larry Hogan comes in, he rescinds it and reallocated all of the money, hundreds of millions of dollars, to outlying road projects in majority white areas, right? And this underscores what I'm talking about. We have, through public policy, intentionally constructed highly segregated neighborhoods of concentrated poverty and highly affluent neighborhoods. And we overinvest in majority white neighborhoods and disinvest and, frankly, prey on people in black neighborhoods. And then we tell stories about the people in the hood to justify the way things are.
And we should say Hogan okayed the Purple Line, which is that light rail that actually connects wealthier neighborhoods.
In the wealthiest suburbs of Maryland surrounding Washington, D.C., suburbs that already have more than their fair share of transportation, like $1 billion in infrastructure investment in highways out there, right? Meanwhile, the carless poor folks who need a transportation, public transportation, to get to a job, what does Hogan say? He said that would be a wasteful boondoggle.
All right. Well, I want to go through some of those three main processes in which the residential caste system is maintained. And you touched on these, but I want to go a little bit deeper into them. The first is the boundary maintenance, which there's been different mechanisms over the years that have done this, including, like you say, highway development and redlining. Let's just talk about the redlining, because I've read some, revision of the revision as of late, which suggested that it wasn't necessarily exclusively racially based. But for the most part, there's at the very least a de facto racial element to this, right? I mean, in terms of where it ultimately lands. But just walk us through. I think, you know, we've talked about redlining as a process, but walk us through just sort of how that worked out. We can use Baltimore, but this story is fairly consistent in cities across the country.
Right. I'd encourage the folks who are watching or listening, where you live, if you just Google redlining and the name of your city, right? In the 30s, more than 200 American cities, the Homeowners Loan Corporation pays to have these maps generated where they just every single neighborhood is accorded a grade from A to D, right? Surprise, surprise, whatever the intentions in their head, majority black neighborhoods, with extremely rare exception, even high middle class black neighborhoods, get the D rating, which is marked explicitly as hazardous. And a lot of these neighborhoods were actually quite vital, right? Harlem Park and some of the neighborhoods I'm forgetting the name. It's a famous name of the neighborhood that Freddie Gray lived in. It'll come to me in a minute. But it was like the Harlem of Baltimore, very vital place, nightclubs, stores, everything. Right? They get labeled hazardous. Immediately, it becomes difficult for people who live there to get mortgages, to keep up their home, to get investment, to invest in businesses or whatever. And there's a Fed study that says 8 decades later, they correlate the decision to mark neighborhoods with a D as hazardous with present decline and disinvestment and segregation, right? So the federal government, you can call it racial or whatever, it de facto doesn't matter for the people who are living there, right? They devalued blackness, right? And let me just say, the present manifestation of that policy decision, and by the way, black neighborhoods are still redlined by banks and investors. We could talk about that in a minute. But the present manifestation of this policy is that Black people are cut out of the signature wealth building subsidies of the federal government. And today we have a wealth gap where for every dollar that of wealth that whites on average have, Black people have 8 cents, right? And that is because of intentional public policies.
What were the factors? I mean, do we know what were the factors in making those assessments of the credit worthiness of a neighborhood? And do we have a sense of like what the equation was at that time?
Well, let me say this, Sam. I've read the history and the actual wording used by the underwriters about Black neighborhoods. And they would say things like neighborhoods, even just mixed neighborhoods, but that they said that racial homogeneity was safe and mixing and undesirable populations was a risk. That's what they said explicitly.
So this wasn't, just to be clear, this wasn't like, well, the market capitalization of these homes divided by the infrastructure costs.
No. It was a perception that investing in Black neighborhoods was a risky, right? And again, a lot of these neighborhoods were quite vital, right? Businesses, entertainment corridors, middle class, you know, in those days, all Black people had trouble getting housing somewhere else. So, you know, high-income Black people lived with poor people. They were economically mixed neighborhoods, right? So, you know, I'll leave it to your viewers to decide whether it was consciously racist or de facto. But the what happened as a result of that policy is that Black neighborhoods were redlining, and it made it very difficult to get credit. And meanwhile, majority white neighborhoods, it became suddenly very easy to get a subsidized mortgage such that it was cheaper to go to the suburbs and buy a new home than to rent in the city, right? So through these policy, through this signature policy and more that I talked about with Baltimore's history, what the government did was they shaped grandly residential patterns. And, you know, like I say, Black people were not allowed to participate in the so-called suburban American dream, both because of redlining, but also because of straight up racism, right? Racially restrictive covenants, you know, intentional exclusion of Black people and Jews, frankly, in a lot of these situations from participating in, the neighborhoods that were most invested in over 8 decades.
And we should say, when we talk about wealth disparity in this country, the number one driver of intergenerational wealth is home ownership. And
right.
So if, you know, if you can't get a loan for a certain neighborhood, the value of those houses are going to drop, right? Because, I mean, that's why we see house values rise as interest rates drop, because it becomes cheaper to own a more expensive home. And so over the years, through the generations, the value of these homes don't increase. And therefore, you have that loss of intergenerational wealth building.
Right. And, you know, there's also something else that goes on beyond the redlining and making it difficult. And again, there's a recent study which went back and looked at a lot of the originally redlined cities. And they found, you know, this is like in the 21st century, if you were Black or Latino, equally qualified with whites for mortgages, you still were apt to be discriminated against. And we still get a lot of redlining, particularly in majority Black and majority Latino neighborhoods. So perceptions of Black and brown people in their neighborhoods got shaped, and that it actually also increased avoidance by white people from those neighborhoods. Why? Because if a neighborhood is chronically disinvested, it looks shabbier. People can't pay for their homes. And what happens is people begin to associate the conditions in those neighborhoods with the people who live there, right? And perceptions also, as you say, have everything to do with markets and the value of homes, right? A market reflects what people want, right?
And there's nothing I feel like more direct that the government could have done than the building of highways through certain neighborhoods or the withholding of like transit services and building, you know, a subway line in one different area, which I know you write about a little bit. Like, that's a direct disinvestment in one area and investment in another, which creates, I mean, you can talk about like, oh, does the market decide this? And can people draw direct lines to this is a racist policy? But that is clear and obvious racist policy.
Right. When you prefer, I mean, I don't profess to know what's in Larry Hogan's heart, but at least it's clearly structurally racist for them to take, $750 million from initially earmarked area that was going to get the construction started on the Red Line and transfer it to majority white areas for roads there and not even fill one pothole in the same black neighborhoods with that money, right? You could call that looks racist to me, at least in terms of its impact, right? And civil rights claims were filed because of that, right? And good morning, Emma. I'm glad you're in the conversation.
No, yes, good morning to you.
Well, let's turn to the what you call opportunity hoarding and the dynamic of underinvestment in these neighborhoods and then the overinvestment and these other neighbors. How does that work in practice? I mean, we have, you know, we can see this. The most obvious thing, obviously, is schools, which again is self-perpetuating in terms of the property values in that area, because much of our schools are financed through a function of property taxes. Where else? I mean, how else do we see that? How does that disparity work in terms of investment? And presumably this is by the government too.
Right. So very important question, right? What happens when you construct neighborhoods that are extremely different by race and class, overwhelmingly affluent, you know, poverty-free neighborhoods and concentrated poverty neighborhoods or just, you know, struggling middle-class neighborhoods. And by the way, since the 2000s, these demarcations have become sharper, right? It's gotten harder for everybody to get into affluent neighborhoods. And it's also gotten harder to get out of struggling neighborhoods. But what does that do? It creates a direct horizontal competition for limited public and private investment between influential high opportunity areas and frankly everywhere else. And I've been writing about this for two decades, and what you find if you actually look at the numbers in any given city, it's not surprising that affluent people tend to be able to bend public policies and private investment to their will, right? To get the kinds of, you know, luxury investment and subsidies to support that and golden infrastructure. And by the way, to the listeners here, I want you to understand that, you know, something like only about a really small percentage of the population gets to live in the highest opportunity places, but everybody who's excluded from those areas is subsidizing them with their gas tax dollars, you know, their sales taxes, their income taxes, right? So I have concrete numbers. In Chicago, a recent study found that white neighborhoods get three times as much public and private investment as black ones. In Baltimore, again, even under a city that ostensibly has majority black representation, they found that they were spending four times as much, right? And that is that kind of disparity is replicated all over the country. I cite this study for this book, and I can't remember the title. Apologies to the author, but he looked at development patterns. You know, since the 2000s, before the pandemic, you know, there was a back to city movement, and a lot of cities were redeveloping, particularly their downtown areas. Some people would say gentrifying, you know, becoming tech hubs or whatever. And what he found was a lot of spaces were whitening, and you know, all the up and coming neighborhoods. At the same time that the cities were so-called revitalizing, a lot of majority Black and Brown neighborhoods were becoming poorer, in part because they just weren't getting their fair share of the basic kind of investments that fuel community development. And this is kind of part of the reason I wrote this book, is these processes are largely invisible except to people who pay very close attention to developers and what deals are being made.
To what extent, I mean, and I want to ultimately get to the stereotype driven surveillance, but since we're here and we're talking about this sort of, I guess 21st century,
residential cast.
No, the residential cast, but the return to the cities.
Right.
But to what extent does this residential caste phenomena exist outside of the cities? I mean, we have it in terms of obviously, like, you know, some remnants of white flight to the suburbs and support for those suburban areas. But I'm curious as to where we find poverty in other areas. To what extent can you apply both ends of this equation in non-urban areas? I'm curious if that exists.
Right. So absolutely, race and class segregation exists in the suburbs. In fact, concentrated poverty is growing fastest in the suburbs, struggling suburbs, and a lot of formerly middle-class white people, after the housing crisis, experienced concentrated poverty for the first time. So I want to emphasize this. So residential caste was constructed, beginning in the 30s, out of fear of Blacks in large numbers, right? But the system, and it continues with these anti-Black processes of boundary maintenance and opportunity hoarding and surveillance, which we'll get to. But white people, struggling white people are harmed by it too, right? My whole point is this system of residential caste only works for the really small percentage of the population that can afford to buy their way into poverty-free havens.
Well, I'm curious as to that relationship, because, you know, like, I think we can see in the Jim Crow era, and when we see like that disenfranchisement following Reconstruction of Black voters, those former plantation owners and others who were interested in disenfranchising Black voters were also more than happy to disenfranchise poor white voters if that was the price that was involved in, like, you know, okay, we're gonna cast a net, and some is gonna be tuna and there'll be some dolphins in there, and as long as we get that stuff out of there. How does, and on some level, it feels like this residential caste system functions in a similar fashion to that. Are all three processes involved in that when we see it outside of urban centers, or in areas where there's not as many Black people, or is it more focused on just, like, you know, the opportunity hoarding?
Okay, so for your listeners, just I want to recap. So we have a system of residential caste. There are three anti-Black processes that undergird it, right? Boundaries, hoarding, and surveillance, right? When people try, of any color, And I'd say in metropolitan areas, the one thing I'll say is I don't have enough data to tell you whether my theories about residential caste apply to rural, sparsely populated areas. I just don't have that data, and I won't make that claim. But I will make the claim in metropolitan areas, which includes suburbs, which the majority of people in this country live in a metropolitan area, that these systems continue. How does it affect white folks, right? Basically, anytime you enter the market trying to buy a home or rent an apartment, unless you are affluent, right? Unless you have money, right? Your choices are constrained because of this system, right? In many cities across this country, it is illegal to build anything other than a single family detached house on as much as 3/4 of the property, right? You have a lot of Gen Xers. I see it in my students coming out of law school, laden with debt, right? Young people trying to get a piece of this American dream, right? And you have a residential system, but you know, and one of the big way, the main ways we maintain boundaries today is through zoning. And so if you're in a city or metropolitan area where all the high opportunity places, the only way to get there is to be able to afford a single family detached home. And in my city, you're talking $1 million or more, right? In a lot of these places, you are locked out, right? So that's what, that's the point I'm making. Now, you know, the title is provocative, and I'll be honest, right? I wrote this book out of anger about how difficult it is for my poor Black brothers and sisters to get out, to get to opportunity. That's what motivated the book. But I am very, very clear, particularly in the final chapter, that we need a multiracial coalition that wants something better than a society that's premised on separation and fear and locking others out. And that, you know, so I hope that clarifies my point.
It does. And so let's touch on the stereotype driven surveillance. And then I do want to go into the examples of how we can fix this, at least in those policies. I mean, you touch on, you know, some of the zoning stuff is one of the big issues on that. But let's first just, I want to just cover the last of the three processes that that maintain this residential caste, and that being what you call stereotype driven surveillance.
Right, and I think this one is the most familiar to, dare I say it, woke people, because of the videos, because of George Floyd's slow execution, Ahmaud Arbery, you know, a tragic, senseless death. We just see these videos. So there's, when you create very different neighborhoods, in Black neighborhoods, there's a very different type of policing that goes on in affluent white space, right? You have a sort of militarized policing. This is the one area that government overinvests in the Black neighborhoods, policing and incarceration. And a lot, police apply a lens, particularly to younger Black men, a presumed thug rather than presumed citizen. Everybody is a potential criminal, and they react to them as such, right? Stop and frisk everybody, right? Surprise, surprise, you stop and frisk everybody, you get more arrests.
Right.
You get more people incarcerated. So there's that kind of policing, but then there's also private surveillance. And, you know, it's so heartbreaking, right? The Ahmaud Arbery video shows the worst of it, gun-toting vigilantism, right? But then, you know, Chris Cooper, I start my book with him, a Harvard-educated bird watcher gets the police called on him, right? So, and you've seen the videos about the Karens. There's a phenomenon of Black bodies, and it doesn't matter how respectable you look, being policed and surveilled by people who lack the cultural dexterity to see ordinary behavior as non-threatening, you know? And I draw a distinction. You know, Black people have more allies than they've ever had in this country. So this book is not anti-white. I'm not beating up on all white people. What I'm saying is that, you know, I said, for people who don't do the work of looking at individual behavior as opposed to people's skin color to decide whether someone's a threat, you know, we get policing, particularly in gentrifying areas. And I told it that the social tension is can be very high in gentrifying areas that are transitioning from a neighborhood of color to whiter, right? And non-dexterous people, people who don't practice pluralism, who aren't particularly down with learning about different cultural norms, like Dominicans who like to play dominoes on the sidewalk, right? 105-year-old Dominican man had the police called on him multiple times because someone just couldn't accept him and his buddies playing dominoes on the sidewalk. That's the surveillance I talk about. And boundaries animate it, right? If you don't have, I mean, I sorry to say this, but, well, I guess I shouldn't be defensive about it, but the average white person in this country lives in a neighborhood that's 76% white. That's average. So if you live in a very white space, you don't get a lot of practice dealing with and knowing people who are not white, right? And so a lot of this surveillance is about policing territory and boundaries, right? That's part of residential caste. It's a big part of it.
And isn't a huge part of it, too, the fact that, like, I don't know when the last time the federal government actually invested in low-income housing was. I mean, pre-Reagan, that's just, like, out of the political conversation now. And especially in areas like the one that you're describing, it's not even imagined that that could be a possibility in, like, the over the past 40 years.
Yeah, Emma, this is such a good question. Thank you for asking it. And you alluded to this, Sam, earlier. So why do we have all these policies, right? Part of it is we have I call it mythology, right? We have stories we tell ourselves about the people who live in the hood. And surprise, surprise, that shapes what policies are acceptable. So when we say public housing, what comes to mind to people, if we're intellectually honest about it, right? You know, fear of. I'm not going to repeat the stereotypes, right? I'm not going to participate in it. But public housing, like welfare, right, is associated with the nastiest negative stereotypes of Black people, right? When in fact, and I try to debunk this with a chapter in which I feature, you know, people who live in public housing want the same thing everybody else does. Everybody else wants quality schools, you know, so I try to humanize these folks. But because of that pervasive stereotype, because of five decades of politicians, particularly presidential aspirants, stoking stereotypes. Stereotypes: welfare queen, thug, super predator, looter, right? It becomes very difficult to get political support for public housing. And yet, you know, we basically, yes, 40 years, the government just stopped building new units, right? Our competitors in Europe, public housing, they may call it government housing, they build units, surprise, surprise, for citizens to be able to get in stable housing at a decent price. But we just stopped doing that. We do have some, vouchers and stuff, but we largely exited the business of government building housing. We try to incentivize affordable housing through, you know, tax incentives and things like that. But even with that program, it's about $10 billion a year, the low-income housing tax credit. We're basically What gets built is in already poor areas. So our biggest subsidy for affordable housing is actually investing in concentrating poverty.
Let's talk about the things that have been working about in terms of integrating and investing in neighborhoods. You mentioned Minneapolis as an example of investment and also zoning as a potential fix. Walk us through that.
Right. And let me just emphasize, it's once you understand these processes, and it's maybe depressing to slog through, but I think it's a great read. The beauty is that the way forward is clear. All you have to do is reverse these policies, right? And I try in the final chapter, Abolition and Repair, to hold up positive, hopeful examples like Minneapolis of doing this. So to your question, right? After years of educating citizens there about how Minneapolis got so segregated, this history will be marched through. They had a majority political consensus for adopting an inclusionary zoning ordinance that required that every neighborhood in Minneapolis has to have something, be open to other types of housing, not just single family housing, you know, duplexes, quadplexes, apartment buildings. Every neighborhood has to be at least open to them or can't ban them. All right. That is really, really radical. And I applaud them for doing it. They also adopted, I don't know the specific details, but they have a policy of racial equity where they are looking at the dollars and budgets and paying attention to, you know, where the dollars are going and trying to disrupt or at least channel resources into historically defunded neighborhoods, right? So that's an example of repair. And if you do that, you're not going to solve these problems overnight, right? But like California, so-called liberal California, they have a terrible housing crisis. They are 3 million housing units short of what is needed for the people who want it, right? And the legislature there, after years of fighting, finally got through a requirement that all neighborhoods have to be open to duplexes. You know, that's a start, right? But what I see, the positive note is that I see in most cities a multiracial coalition that gets you to 51%, and it's a progressive coalition that's open to trying things, innovating. There are thousands of communities across this country that have inclusionary zoning ordinances. There are a number of communities that are adopting racial equity analysis. So it's not hopeless, right? There are things you can do on the ground that make things better. And I'll say those communities that are less segregated, their economies tend to be better. They're, the indicia about social mobility for poor children, they're much higher. This is Raj Chetty, worked in from Harvard. So it's possible through public policy to make things better. And I believe more integrated cities are probably happier places to be even for wealthy people, right? If there's less poverty and there's more inclusion, you're going to get less social dissension, less crime, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the book is White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding, and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Cheryl Cashin, professor at Georgetown University Law Center, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm.
It's been great being with you, Sam and Emma.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks. Just a word first from a sponsor. If you run a business, you can supercharge your success with Shopify. It's the all-in-one commerce platform. Start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses. So upstarts, startups, even podcasts selling merchandise, as well as established businesses alike, can sell everywhere, synchronize their online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial.
and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. All right, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
There is a 2 hours plus of new literary hangover content for folks on the literary hangover feed. We talk about John Milton's Areopagitica, a famous free speech pamphlet written in 1644, after about 4 years of open sort of dialogue and free speech after the during the Civil War between Parliament and the King. And he's writing that we should not end this and that free speech is good. We also talk about how Milton shouldn't be understood as mainly as a poet, but as a political writer. He was the Secretary of Foreign Tongues under Cromwell's revolutionary Republican government until that experiment broke. And then he wrote Paradise Lost. So we go into the politics of Milton, defender of regicide, a first defender of regicide, according to Frederick Engels.
Secretary of Foreign Tongues?
Yeah, he all the diplomacy back then was like in Latin and French and stuff. So he was just a sort of genius with languages. So he would do all the translating and letter writing. And he also was a propagandist against the return of the king, which did happen. So he failed, but yeah.
Well, at least he tried.
Yes.
I wouldn't mind bringing that back, the Secretary of Foreign Tongues.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I just think that would be pretty cool.
I don't think like Pompeo could do that, though.
No, somebody else would have to come in.
That was the role of what? Like Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, right? Yeah.
Is that right?
I mean, not really, but he was basically manipulating the king and weakening him with his poison words.
Lord of the Rings. No, yeah. It's been a while for me. Folks! 646-257-3920 is the number. I'm up on my Harry Potter stuff, though.
Oh, you are, yeah.
Yeah.
I know, we did spoil that one for you. That one thing.
Don't remind me what it was.
Okay, we won't.
We're going to head into the fun half. You can IM the show at majorityapp.com. What?
It just came up on my computer. Dave Gettleman's out as the general manager Giants. It's like, I feel like I just took drugs or something. It's like there's a huge weight off me.
This is going to
be a fun half.
Watch out, folks. You're going to want to join us.
Black Monday.
Things are going to get crazy because Emma got good news about her Giants.
Oh, man.
All right. See you in the fun half. You okay?
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library,
What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.